Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Today started like most workdays.
5:30 a.m.
The alarm.
6 a.m.
A calendar reminder. It's Spirit Week for second grade, so I got to make sure Anna wears her orange t-shirt.
7 a.m.
Post a little red heart like on Twitter for the daily sunrise photo tweeted by our takeaway director, Jay Cowett.
8 a.m.
The Apple Watch has an attitude and tells me to check my rings because normally I'm further along by now. Leave me alone, Siri.
Okay, Melissa, whatever you say. 9 a.m.
I preset my lunch order for delivery on DoorDash. So it's not even midday, and I've already told my phone tons of information about my schedule, my work, my location, my family, my food preferences, and my health practices. Harmless enough if these events were hastily scribbled notes in a personal journal, but these data are far more public. Each of our daily smartphone interactions is a cyber breadcrumb in a personal digital trail. A trail hungrily pursued by advertisers pushing their products into our carefully crafted algorithms. But it's not just about products. It's also potentially about punishment. Law enforcement already uses digital footprints in criminal cases. For example, when the Department of Justice was looking to identify people involved in the January 6th Capitol attack, it subpoenaed cell phone data. So what if your cell phone data shows you search for a reproductive health care clinic, or that you looked up how to order abortion medication online? In March, Missouri considered a law to make it illegal to, quote, aid or abet out-of-state abortion. And it's not difficult to imagine using location services on a smartphone to track and prove the whereabouts of a woman seeking a legal abortion across state lines. So, in the wake of the recently leaked draft opinion suggesting that the Supreme Court is ready to overturn Roe v. Wade, privacy experts are expressing concerns that if abortion or access to reproductive care becomes widely criminalized, law enforcement officials and prosecutors could use smartphone data as a surveillance tool. I'm joined now by Cynthia Conti Cook, civil rights attorney and current technology fellow on the Ford Foundation's Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Justice team. Welcome to The Takeaway, Cynthia.
Thank you. I'm happy to be speaking with you.
I'm also joined by Yvka Pierre, senior litigation counsel at If, When, How, a national network of legal professionals focused on reproductive justice. Welcome to The Takeaway, Yvka.
Hi, y'all. How's everybody doing?
Well, it's a tough one, right? And Yvka, actually, let me start with you on this. I'm wondering, as we're sort of looking at this, you know, potential future, is this something that's only in the future, or have we seen reproductive choices or reproductive experiences already been being criminalized?
I mean, yes. Yes is the quick short answer, and yes and is the longer answer. As long as folks have been able to get pregnant, people have been, you know, able to and sought ways to not be pregnant. And in the United States, what we have traditionally seen, though abortion is not something that has always been criminalized, even after Roe, we have seen folks be criminalized for seeking to end a pregnancy, whether that's seeking to end a pregnancy on their own, a process called self-managed abortion, seeking to end a pregnancy through assistance by others. In an in-depth project that If When How has been doing to analyze and collect information on arrests for self-managed abortion, we can find from the year 2000 to present day, more than 60 cases where someone has been prosecuted for their self-managed abortion or for assisting someone in doing so.
All right. So, Cynthia, let me come to you on this. So we know that there's already some level of criminalization around choices and experiences of termination. But has technology been part of any of, you know, of these cases? Are we just being alarmist about how our smartphone data could be used?
Not at all. It has absolutely already been used in prosecution. And when we say that data will increase and escalate the criminalization of abortion, let's take that apart. It means two things. So there's the increase from surveillance and there's an increase from prosecution. What we're speaking about at the moment is an increase in prosecution because that digital evidence is being included in the prosecution to, for example, illustrate, as the prosecutors see it, the intent of someone. And already there has been examples of digital evidence, and it's not what we are thinking, perhaps speculating around our menstrual apps and that sort of data. It's much more common to see the text messages to your friends, to see the websites that you visited or the email receipts that you get when you buy the abortion pills online. It's the very commonplace type of information that everyone is creating and everyone is having extracted from their criminal case if they're already in the midst of an investigation and prosecution.
Why wouldn't you be protected under a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate yourself by your own text messages here?
The Fifth Amendment, unfortunately, does not extend to your digital devices, to your digital information.
Just that. So I'm sorry. I was like, it's as simple as that, that we simply aren't covered with that constitutionally protected right against self-incrimination if we self-incriminate digitally.
So the Fourth Amendment should be the protection that we have over the digital devices. The Fifth Amendment, in my opinion, should also include digital devices, but so far courts have not exactly gone there. The Fourth Amendment, the protection from search and seizure, has not been extended very generously by courts to digital information. In fact, the Supreme Court only included cell phone site location data as something that could be protected in 2017 in a case called Carpenter, because the reason that a lot of this protection hasn't come into play is because of a doctrine called the third party doctrine. As long as we're sharing that data with the companies, the courts have always assumed that we should not have sort of a privacy interest in that data.
All right. Ivka, I'm wondering, you know, in our conversations at this point about the potential end of Roe v. Wade protections, you know, we've talked a lot about how that is likely to have disparate impact on people capable of pregnancy, depending on poverty status, race, you know, obviously geography, you know, which state you live in. Is that also true here in the context of digital surveillance? Are we expecting that there, Ivka, would be some categories of people who would be closer to surveillance and criminalization than others?
I think that's absolutely right. When we're looking at the criminal legal system as a whole, we can see that the strong arm of justice, right, the hammer of justice, does not fall upon everyone equally. What we are seeing are, and what we will likely see, is that folks who are blocked from access of being able to access a clinical abortion if they would like to do so, folks that aren't able to make the full-on decisions that they want to about their reproductive lives, are going to be the folks that are more likely to turn to self-managed abortion, be pulled towards self-managed abortion pushed towards self-managed abortion, I should say. And those are the folks that are also more likely to be criminalized. There are folks that live in communities that are already policed, right? There are folks that are already heavily surveyed. The same groups of folks that when they come to a healthcare professional are less likely to be believed about things like pain, less likely to be believed about their own bodies, right? Those are the same people that are more likely to be targeted by police. They're more likely to be targeted by prosecutions when it's time to make a decision about whether this is a tragedy or whether this is a crime. Prosecutors are more likely to go after those folks. And we should kind of name things in the room, right? These are people who are poor, people who are Black and Brown, folks that live in communities that don't have a ton of access to healthcare. Those are the folks that are likely to be prosecuted. And also, when we're looking at the full span of how digital evidence gets used in the criminal legal system, oftentimes it's people who don't know their rights and what they can say yes and no to. And I'm sure Cynthia is going to be able to talk about this in more depth, but oftentimes law enforcement because they're able to not tell the truth to people that they're investigating, will just say, I need to have your phone. Let me see what's in your phone. What's your password? And folks just hand that information over because they don't know they're allowed to say no. And also, quite frankly, even if some people say no, that no is not always respected, right? And then they can have access to your phone and they can go through your phone and pull your text messages and pull your searches through whatever extraction program that police office is currently using.
So Cynthia, as Ivka's talking about, you know, sort of knowing your rights and even being structurally or in an identity sense, right, positioned to assert those rights, help us to understand what are some of the legal rights and also what are some of the maybe technological pathways that folks can start taking to try to protect themselves?
Sure. I mean, it's really important for everyone to know that when you are in an interaction, not only with police officers, but with social workers, with caseworkers, with probation officers, with parole officers, that the request for a digital device, unless there's, you know, you're on probation and parole and they already have told you that your digital devices are part of what they will routinely surveil and you've had to agree to that in writing, which sometimes happens. But in any situation where law enforcement, also including immigration, is demanding access to your digital device, if you can say no, you should say no and hand your device over to an attorney or someone else who is involved in your representation in that case. And then the attorney can take it to the court to determine the scope of the allowed access to your digital devices. But don't hand your phone over is step one. Step two is get really comfortable using encrypted communication. Get all of your contacts imported to your encrypted communication apps now so that you can very casually use it just to say hi, just to say how are you, so that when you are in crisis moment or if you're helping someone who's in crisis moment, you don't have to worry about downloading something new and figuring it out. Same thing for anti-fingerprinting browsers. Get really comfortable using them so that they are not tracking what website you go to every time you switch your websites or what you search for. And do that now. Again, use it to look up, you know, what shampoo you want to buy or whatever, so that you are well-versed in how that website works. And when you're in a moment of panic, you're not just defaulting to these apps that are vacuuming up a huge amount of our information and then trading it.
Cynthia Conti Cook is an award-winning civil rights attorney and current technology fellow at the Ford Foundation's Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Justice Team. And Ivka Pierre is senior litigation counsel at If, When, How, a national network of legal professionals focused on reproductive justice. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.